Hi. Now that I've found my spot, I'm Marty Kreisworth. I'm Dean of Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies and Associate Provost of Graduate Education here at McGill. And I am extremely pleased to be here on this Montreal Spring Day to welcome you and to have you participate in the 3 Minute to Change the World. This is the third year that we have had this event, where we bring in presenters from our graduate students, among our graduate students, who will take the research that they're doing and compress it into 3 minutes and present it in a way that is easily digested by all of us who are not in the discipline, and presumably also those who are in the discipline. There's a little difference this year. So we've been doing this for 3 years. 3 years ago, we were in the vanguard of this kind of thing. We weren't the first. There were a number of places that had been done it before. In fact, my memory, I could be wrong, but my memory is that it started in Australia. And some of them were competitions, and some of them were just presentations. And in the past 2 years, we did them just in terms of presentations. This year, we have some differences. One is that we do have a competition element this year. So the presenters will be competing. It's not a contact sport, but they will be competing for a space on the national competition that's sponsored by the Canadian Association of Graduate Schools, CAGS. The other difference, so we have judges. I'll stay with the judges for a second. So we have three esteemed judges from the university. We have Oliver Dienz, who is actually a dean of students, but also a scholar in literature. We have Rosie Goldstein, who is the VP of Research and International Relations and is in the Faculty of Medicine. And we have Jean-Jacques Lebrun, who is also in the Faculty of Medicine, but he's also Associate Dean in Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Studies. The other, aside from judgment, we also have presentations this year in French. So we have a bilingual interdisciplinary group. The goal here, and it's a laudable one, because we should be able to, scholars should all be able to take their research and present it in a form that can be understood by everyone else. And we also should be able to say what the impact of that research is. And that is what our goal is for these presentations, and that's how they will be judged. So without further ado, I want to introduce the moderator today, who is Professor Paul Yachnin. Professor Paul Yachnin is the Tomlinson Professor of Shakespeare here at McGill, and also the director of iPlay, and I always have to get this right, the Institute for the Public Life of Arts and Ideas. I don't know why I can't remember that, but I can't. And that is a very interesting interdisciplinary institute, and Paul is perfectly suited to be able to moderate this because he has wide interdisciplinary interests. Paul.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Oh, one more thing. Sorry. I want to thank some people. I'm sorry about it. Can't do this without thanking. So I want to thank, first of all, the GPS staff, the Graduate Postdoctoral Studies, and there's Jennifer Johnson here, and Mona is outside, who've been extraordinarily helpful in putting this together. I also want to thank the PGSS members, and they're our host today at Thompson House, so I want to thank them for that. But I also want to thank two particular people, Lean Bourdage and Shona Watt. I also want to thank Teaching and Learning Services, who helped with preparation for these presentations. Okay, now Paul, sorry.
Thank you, Marty.
Welcome, everybody. It's a real honor to be moderating this 3 Minute to Change the World event. I've had a chance to meet some of the presenters and talk to them. It is such an extraordinary opportunity to hear research from these brilliant young scholars and scientists. I should say that iPlay is a humanities-focused institute, but one of the things that we have started to do this year is to work with faculty members and postdocs from psychiatry and psychology on a long-term project on brain, mind, and soul. You know that this event is being live-streamed, so even if the person you're waiting for is not present here, they are probably watching you at home in bed. Also, we're going to keep the questions to the end. So we're going to move at a smart pace through the presentations. And then we will have a chance to ask questions of all the presenters, and then we will hear from the judges. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce... I'm sorry?
Cell phones off.
Oh, yes. Turn your cell phones off. Set them on airplane. I'm going to introduce the first presenter. The first presenter is Jay Olson, who is in psychiatry. His topic, his thesis, is called Using Magic to Influence Choice. Jay grew up in Vancouver. He began magic at the age of 5 when a magician pulled a coin from his ear. And he has been performing magic ever since. In his master's degree in psychiatry, with his supervisor is Amir Raz, he studies the psychology of magic. He examines how magic works in the mind. He's interested in health improvement. Last year, he developed a jet lag prevention strategy, Marty, that has been seen on media outlets such as NBC and CNN. It is now used by airlines in training of their flight crews. In the summer, he can be found running up and down the Mount Royal stairs. Jay.
Think of a playing card. Whichever card pops into your head first, stick with that selection. My name is Jay Olson, and I study the psychology of magic in order to help people make more informed choices. Magicians often know how tricks work, they know the secrets, but they don't often know why they fool people in the mind. One example of this is known as forcing. Forcing occurs when the magician influences the audience's choices without their awareness. For example, the wording of that initial question, think of a card, influenced your choice. Our study of over 1,000 people showed that most choose the ace of spades or the ace, queen, or king of hearts. Had I worded that question slightly differently, you would have chosen other cards. Since then, we've done a couple main studies on forcing. In one study, I stopped 100 people as they were walking down the street. I mean, not all at once, but one at a time. And I showed them a trick in which I flipped through a deck of cards and they glanced at one in the middle. I used a method called salience forcing, in which one card I made a little bit more salient, a little bit more attention-grabbing than the rest. I hoped that people would choose this card without knowing why they chose it. Indeed, 98% of them, all the ones on the left of the graph, chose that card. Yet only 9% of them, the ones in the yellow, felt influenced. So I could influence almost all of them, and yet almost none of them felt the influence. Next, we reproduced this effect on a computer in the second study. We showed a bunch of cards flipping by very quickly. One card was shown slightly longer than the rest of them. And often people would choose this card without knowing why they chose it. Salience forcing is only one method that magicians use when they're influencing audiences. Yet throughout the day, there are many factors that impact our decisions without our awareness. For example, the color of a plate or the order of items on a restaurant menu can impact food consumption. Next time you're down at a restaurant, keep in mind that you're twice as likely to order from the top or the bottom of the menu rather than from items in the middle. By studying forcing, by studying the factors that magicians use to impact your choices without your awareness, we can find what factors impact our decisions throughout the day. And we can protect ourselves from these factors. The main aim of this research is to help people make more informed and healthy choices through applying what magicians have known for centuries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jay. Actually, it's true. What you say, people also order the second cheapest bottle of wine. The next presenter is Jonathan Cote in neuroscience, And Jonathan's thesis is Entraînement pour renverser la perte d'audition chez les personnes âgées. I'll tell you a little bit about Jonathan. Il est né et a grandi à Montréal et dans les environs. En complétant son bac en sciences biomédicales à l'Université de Montréal, il a découvert sa passion pour la neuroscience. Ainsi, en septembre 2013, il a entamé une maîtresse dans ce domaine à l'Université McGill. Autant que Jonathan aime découvrir de nouvelles notions en neurosciences, il aime tout autant partager sa passion au travers de l'enseignement. Dans ses temps libres, il enseigne dans les bases de la neuroscience dans des écoles primaires et secondaires au travers des programmes comme Mission Cerveau et la Semaine Cerveau en Tête. Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Cote.
Bonjour. Moi, ce qui m'intéresse, ce qui me passionne, c'est de comprendre l'audition, comment ça fonctionne dans le cerveau, et comment est-ce qu'on peut garder cette fonction-là le plus longtemps possible au travers le vieillissement. Si vous regardez la première image, c'est une situation qui peut vous être familière. C'est un souper de famille. Ça, c'est ma grand-mère. Elle semble triste et un peu perdue. Elle ne sait même pas qu'on prend une photo. Ça, c'est parce qu'elle n'est pas capable de faire le focus sur une conversation et de supprimer les sons ambiants. Cette situation-là est plutôt fréquente chez les personnes vieillissantes, pas chez ma grand-mère. Ma grand-mère n'est pas sourde. Si je parle un à un avec elle, elle va tout comprendre sans problème. Alors, cette perte d'audition-là spécifique est aussi quelque chose qui existe chez les rats. Mon laboratoire, avant que j'arrive, a créé un entraînement pour réussir à renverser cette perte d'audition-là chez les rats. L'entraînement, c'est la figure 2 que vous pouvez voir. Il y a deux sons. Un son bon, cible, et un son distracteur. Ces deux sons-là partagent la note la plus basse, la fréquence de base, mais sont différents au niveau des harmoniques, les notes les plus élevées. Quand l'entraînement progresse, les harmoniques diminuent en volume, l'intensité du volume descend, comme on peut voir en gris le 20 décibels. Cette diminution-là de volume rend les sons de plus en plus similaires, car il y a juste la fondamentale qui reste. En faisant cet entraînement-là, on a pu voir les changements à la figure 3. Ça, c'est une carte auditive. Du cortex auditif. Ce sont des électrodes implantées dans l'aire auditive du cerveau du rat et on regarde quelle cellule, quelle fréquence de son il préfère. Donc en haut, avant l'entraînement, naïf, on peut voir qu'il y a autant de sons distracteurs en jaune que de sons cibles en bleu. Mais après l'entraînement, la région pour les sons cibles en bleu est beaucoup plus grande que les sons jaunes, car on a juste deux petites régions. Moi, on va poser la question, Jonathan. Comment est-ce que ça peut arriver chez les humains? Est-ce que cet entraînement-là fonctionne chez les humains? Donc, j'utilise l'image 4, la magnéto-encéphalographie, pour voir la carte auditive chez l'humain, en image 5. Donc, l'image 3 chez le rat et 5 chez l'humain, c'est la même chose, c'est le cortex auditif. Donc, en bleu, on peut voir les régions favorites pour les fréquences basses, et en rouge, favorites pour les fréquences élevées. C'est quelque chose qu'on n'avait jamais vu avant chez l'humain en magnéto-encéphalographie. Alors, il me reste juste à savoir comment l'entraînement va modifier cette carte-là. Ce qui est merveilleux avec ma technique aussi, c'est que je peux voir tous les cerveaux en même temps. Donc, on peut voir comment la communication entre les deux régions va différer. Qu'on peut le voir en 6, l'aire auditive, c'est la grosse, puis préfrontale, c'est en avant, sont activés comme en même temps. Donc, ce que je vais pouvoir faire, c'est 1. Voir si l'entraînement fonctionne et l'implanter chez les personnes âgées comme ma grand-mère. Et deuxièmement, mieux orienter nos recherches chez les rats grâce à une imagerie plus grande comme en 6. Je vous remercie beaucoup de votre attention.
Jonathan. It's very good because I know there are other people here who have difficulty doing just that kind of auditory focusing. And so to provide training even to people outside of the AGE would be very useful. The third presenter is Emily Parkinson from Family Medicine. The title of her research is Over the Phone Interpretation, the Next Generation of Language Access in Healthcare. Emily was born and raised in Toronto, but she has lived also in Mexico, Europe, and the United Kingdom, as well as in other cities in Canada. She graduated from McGill in 2012 with an honors BSc in anatomy and cell biology, and she is now doing her master's degree in family medicine. What inspired her to pursue research in health equity was her mother, the manager of interpretation services at the University Health Network in Toronto. She says few in North America know more about language-based inequities in healthcare than her mother does. And on a lighter side, for fun, she likes traveling, biking, pottery, and music. Emily?
What do you think it would feel like to have a medical problem and not be able to communicate? Let's consider this by taking a hypothetical example. Say you and your family are traveling through Thailand and your young daughter develops an eye infection. So you find a local medical clinic and you hop in a cab. At the clinic, the doctor enters the examination room, takes a look at your daughter and, ooh, no, not good, and she hands you a prescription. Now this is a pretty banal example. But what if you or your loved one were to receive a critical diagnosis? What if you needed to have surgery? In this circumstance, how could you feel listened to, reassured, informed, or engaged as a patient if you could not communicate with your care provider? Well, this is what professional interpreters are for, and yet professional interpreters are rarely used in many parts of Canada, including Montreal. Hence, the purpose of my research is to explore the feasibility of using over-the-phone interpretation as a means of integrating language support services into Montreal health systems. And in the next 2 minutes, let's go over the following topics. One, the impact of language barriers on health and healthcare. Two, the current standards of practice. And three, how these standards might be improved. So one, limited language skills are directly associated with poor quality of care and access to healthcare services in Canada. In fact, the health status of the immigrant population actually gets worse following their arrival into Canada. Compared to native-born Canadians, this population arrives in the emergency more often and has poorer management of chronic diseases such as diabetes. The use of in-person interpreters, however, improves the patient satisfaction, their safety, and the efficiency of care delivery. It also reduces medical error rates and the resulting liability costs for negative patient outcomes. And yet, too, with budget constraints and little to no training of care providers in how and when to access professional interpreters, care providers most often use untrained interpreters such as family members or even a stranger from the waiting room. In terms of patient safety, confidentiality, and autonomy, this is problematic. So for my master's research, I'll be piloting phone interpretation in Montreal family medicine clinics. Compared to in-person interpretation, this service provides fast, convenient, and affordable access to trained interpreters in essentially any language. It's become the standard of care in places such as Australia, the United States, and in parts of Canada. So this service works, but we want to know if it works in Montreal. So let's travel back to Thailand now, and I invite you to take a look and think about how using phone interpretation services may have changed that experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Emily. I'm just, you know, I was actually at a lecture this morning by someone who works in digital humanities, and one of the things that he's looking at is the capacity of programs to do translation. And I wonder if you could have that kind of technical intermediary in these kinds of situations. The fourth presenter is Alexandra Blair in psychiatry. Alexandra's thesis is How Do Neighborhoods Affect Mental Health? I'll tell you about her. Alexandra is originally from Chelsea, Quebec. She came to McGill for her undergraduate degree in environmental studies and is now completing a master's degree in psychiatry. Does that seem like a leap to you she asks us. She doesn't think so. Alexandra has always been interested in how environments affect mental health in Canada. Based at the Douglas Hospital, her master's research focuses on how neighborhoods affect mental health. Living in Montreal since 2008, Alexandra is often inspired by the social, economic, and political landscapes of Montreal in her research. One of her favorite pastimes in the city is urban gardening, which to her is a perfect example of how neighborhoods can get people to work together, exchange know-how, and feel better about themselves at the end of the day. Alexandra.
Did you know that as Canadians, one in four of us is expected to be diagnosed with clinical depression during our lifetime? Depression is one of the world's most serious public health issues. And like most public health issues, the best way of dealing with depression is to prevent it. My research asks, what if the solution to preventing depression lies not only at an individual level, but beyond? What if the solution was in the streets of our neighborhoods? My name is Alexandra, and in my master's thesis, I answer the question of how neighborhoods affect mental health. To answer this question, I look to existing neighborhood-level studies, as well as census and health survey data from all cities across Canada. What I found was really interesting. There are three features of neighborhoods that affect mental health. The first is the social environment. People living in neighborhoods with strong social ties and vibrant communities tend to be less depressed. The second feature is the physical environment. People living in neighborhoods where the trash is picked up, where the streets are well lit, and where people feel safe enough to go outside and ride a bicycle tend to be less depressed. The third feature is the economic environment. People living in low-income neighborhoods are consistently more depressed than people living in more affluent areas. This is a big deal. This means that potentially, by improving the social, physical, and economic environments of neighborhoods, we can prevent depression on a very large scale. So what next? Do we just pour money into low-income neighborhoods in Canada? Maybe not. In fact, when I look at Canadian data, I see that residents living in low-income neighborhoods that become more affluent through time, they experience more psychological distress. Why? Because when neighborhoods become more affluent, costs of living go up. And when more affluent residents move in, long-term residents start to feel excluded from the communities they used to know so well. So what now? Well, better strategies might be to invest in social spaces and physical infrastructure, like parks and community centers, all the while protecting those residents that are economically vulnerable. If we're going to prevent depression at a large scale at a neighborhood level, we need to take into account the social, the physical, and the economic all at once. Thank you for your attention.
It's also weather. It's a really nice city here that we live in. It really sucks for the past little while, but it's changing now. I feel happier. The next presenter is Ariane Laferrière, who is in the Faculty de Droit. And her thesis is La Prairena Plaza, Les droits des femmes dans l'industrie de vêtements au Bangladesh. I'll tell you something about Ariane. Elle est née ici au Québec. Elle a déménagé à Montréal il y a 6 ans. Son bac en droit à l'Université de Montréal, she got it in 2011, et ses examens de l'École au barreau du Québec were completed in 2011 as well. Elle est en deuxième année maintenant de maîtresse en droit et se spécialise en droit international des droits de la femme. Elle est féministe. Elle est pour l'égalité l'homme et femme. Lorsqu'elle travaille pas à son mémoire, elle beaucoup faire de sport, course à pied, vélo, natation, randonnée en montagne. Elle revient de Bangladesh où elle a fait de la recherche pour son mémoire. Ça fait une expérience sensationnelle, autant sur le plan professionnel que personnel. Elle retient surtout de son voyage l'accueil chaleureux des Bangladais, ainsi que leur gentillesse et leur générosité. Mesdames et Messieurs, Ariane Laferrière.
Made in Bangladesh. Si on faisait l'exercice, on retrouverait pour la plupart cette inscription sur au moins un de nos vêtements. Mais à quel prix nos vêtements sont-ils fabriqués? En avril 2013, l'immeuble Rana Plaza, à Dhaka, capitale du Bangladesh, s'est effondré. Il abritait 5 fabriques de vêtements qui fournissaient des compagnies américaines, européennes et canadiennes. 1032 travailleurs sont morts. C'est le plus grave accident de l'histoire dans l'industrie du vêtement. La situation est critique dans l'industrie du vêtement au Bangladesh. En plus des nombreux accidents, les conditions de travail sont souvent déplorables et les salaires sont insuffisants. Après la tragédie du Rana Plaza, des initiatives juridiques ont été prises afin d'améliorer la sécurité et les conditions de travail. Le gouvernement a adopté un plan d'action en collaboration avec l'Organisation internationale du travail. Les multinationales européennes ont signé un accord. Et les multinationales nord-américaines ont opté pour leur propre alliance. L'objectif de ma recherche est, premièrement, de comprendre les causes du problème des conditions de travail, deuxièmement, d'évaluer le potentiel des réponses juridiques après le Rana Plaza, et troisièmement, d'analyser différentes solutions afin de protéger adéquatement les droits des travailleurs. Puisque 85 % des travailleurs du vêtement sont des femmes, j'adopte une perspective axée sur le genre féminin. Je me suis rendue à Dhaka en février dernier afin de rencontrer des dirigeants syndicaux, des chefs d'ONG, des directeurs de fabriques et des travailleuses afin de connaître leur histoire et leur opinion. Le but était que je puisse fonder mon analyse non pas seulement sur la théorie, mais aussi sur l'expérience de ces gens afin de me faire une idée plus juste de la situation. De façon générale, il ressort de mes recherches que les initiatives juridiques après le Rana Plaza ont un potentiel de succès, mais à court terme. À long terme, la solution s'inscrit dans la théorie du développement et une approche fondée sur la capacité des personnes. Il ne s'agit pas de débarquer et d'imposer des changements, mais de faire en sorte que les travailleuses aient elles-mêmes la capacité d'améliorer leurs conditions. Pour cela, il faut leur enseigner leurs droits et il faut aider à la mise en place de syndicats ayant à leur tête ces travailleuses pour qu'elles puissent faire entendre leur voix. En tant que consommateur, on a aussi un rôle à jouer. Le boycott serait nocif pour les travailleuses, mais il faut faire pression sur les multinationales qui produisent les vêtements que nous portons, comme H&M, Zara, Joe Fresh, afin qu'elles agissent. Les emplois créés dans l'industrie du vêtement représentent une avancée positive pour les femmes. Elles veulent ces emplois, mais dans la dignité. C'est dans cette optique que s'inscrit ma recherche. Comprendre le problème pour proposer des solutions afin que les Bangladaises gardent leur emploi, mais dans de meilleures conditions. Ainsi, j'espère que bientôt, nous pourrons tous regarder l'étiquette des vêtements que nous portons et dire fièrement qu'ils sont « Made in Bangladesh with dignity ». Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Ariane. Both my children are labor lawyers. My daughter does disability law. My son is a union side labor lawyer. So I hear what you're saying. And one of the things that we find is that the law can be an instrument of social change. Just look at what we've done with smoking, even in Quebec, because of workers' rights within their workplace. The next presenter is Ira Sutherland, who's in renewable resources. And his thesis is forests, trade-offs, and human sustainability. Ira grew up in Vancouver, snowboarding, big surprise, mountain biking, and he was immersed in nature. Following high school, he left home to travel. He visited 26 countries, climbed over 100 mountains, spent weeks alone in the wilderness, and traversed North America by bicycle. Twice. Such experiences provide broad perspectives, which you will see are reflected in his thesis. Ira completed his undergrad degree at UBC Forestry in 2012, and he started at McGill this past fall. His thesis targets the connection between nature and people. Building awareness for this connection is his passion, and he is honored to have your attention here today. Ira, welcome.
You have all just embarked on a journey to discover the importance of forests, to learn to identify a trade-off, and to use this to shape our path towards sustainability. The story of my thesis begins with us all transported to the west coast of BC to investigate the problem. We arrive to suddenly find ourselves standing in an ancient rainforest with trees hundreds of years old or more. Their towering trunks, draped in moss and ferns, rise above you, and intuitively, you sense value in this forest. Indeed so, because this forest provides our society with many important benefits, including things like clean drinking water, wild edible plants and medicines, and those trees play a vital role in regulating our global climate. Now imagine before our eyes that forest is quickly cut down before us, leaving us to wonder, what values have we lost? And how long will they take to recover? The problem is that nobody actually knows, yet the forest was cut down anyway. In the next scene, we take a step back to have a look at the bigger picture. Clearly, logging the forest provides us with jobs and an exceptionally useful and renewable resource, wood. But cutting down the forest comes at a trade-off. A trade-off is a win-lose scenario, and we all make trade-off decisions every day. For example, should I spend this evening studying for an upcoming exam, or should I spend quality time with my family? So each one of us knows then that trade-offs carry future consequences. Now in the case of cutting our forest down for timber, these consequences may be long-lasting legacies of an increase or of a warming global climate, of species extinctions or degraded water quality in our own communities. And these trade-offs don't just occur in BC, but they occur in forests worldwide. This is a global problem, and it threatens human sustainability. The solution is to learn how to rebalance these trade-offs. But to do that, we need to really understand them, and we need to understand how long they last. And that's exactly the unknown that my research targets with three simple steps. First, I've already figured out how to measure and quantify many of the important benefits that forests provide us. Second, I'm currently in the process of estimating their recovery rates. To do this, I'm using an existing government data set that has tracked forest recovery along a 300-year time span. Lastly, I'll take my results from the 300-year recovery and I'll test them in the field, back in the rainforest of coastal BC. This research will help us minimize the impacts of forestry, and it will contribute to the immense challenge we all face together as a society, which is to rebalance the trade-offs that threaten our sustainability. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ira. I was just thinking that I do not envy the judges their task today. The presenters are just marvelously talented, and your projects are as good as you are. The next presenter is Nilmini Mendes in microbiology. Excuse me. Nilmini's topic is À la chasse des bactéries cache, l'histoire de Legionella. Nilmini was born and partly raised in Sri Lanka, studied microbiology and immunology here at McGill, has lived in Quebec for 12 years. Nilmini has always been interested in public health and teaching. The lab in which Nilmini works and the research that they do touches health, policy making, and teaching through mentoring. Anil Mani couldn't pass up on this opportunity to compete and cooperate with a group of young colleagues to talk about the work that we do and they do at McGill. The best part of Neil Minney's work is that split second of indescribable contentment when you figure out the solution to something that has baffled and or frustrated, in most cases, both you and others. Neil Minney.
L'été 2012, la ville de Québec a connu la plus grande éclosion de légionellose dans l'Amérique du Nord. Septembre de la même année, j'ai plongé dans le monde des bactéries. Depuis, j'étudie Legionella pneumophila, la cause de la légionellose, une pneumonie des fois mortelle. Legionella est une bactérie qui contamine les tours de refroidissement. L'image 1 montre le tour contaminé sur le complexe Jacques-Cartier, coupable de l'éclosion de Québec. Bon. Tout le monde sait que les bactéries sont trop petites pour qu'on puisse les voir à l'œil nu. Alors, comment détecter les Legionella dans nos tours? La méthode la plus populaire est de les cultiver sur les boîtes de gélose, comme on voit sur l'image 2. Un échantillon d'eau contaminé par les Legionella produit sur la gélose des tas de cellules visibles qu'on appelle des colonies. Le nombre de colonies est une réflexion directe des nombres de bactéries. Allons-y à l'image 3. Où j'ai trouvé que quand les Legionella se trouvent dans l'eau froide, le nombre de colonies produites diminue très rapidement comparé à une température d'eau de 25 degrés. Normalement, on aurait dit que cette bactérie survit très mal ou qu'elle meurt à 4 degrés. Mais cette fois-ci, on a décidé de voir si la bactérie nous jouait un petit tour en refusant de pousser sur la gélose. Ça m'amène à l'image 4, où on a utilisé deux molécules. L'une fluorescent en rouge si la bactérie est morte et l'autre en vert si elle est vivante. Donc, notre légionella dans l'eau froide, qui ne produisait aucune colonie au moment du marquage, était marquée majoritairement en vert. Ça veut dire qu'effectivement, légionella jouait au cache-cache et restait vivante dans l'eau froide, mais ne produisait aucune colonie. Pourquoi ça nous intéresse? Parce qu'une bactérie vivante pour nous rendre malades. Ces résultats montrent qu'un manque de colonies n'est pas égal à une source d'eau propre. Ce qui est troublant, c'est que ça remet en question nos méthodes de détection. Un échantillonnage d'eau fait, par exemple, au printemps, quand il fait froid, surtout celui-là, va gravement sous-estimer le niveau de contamination. Sur un plan pratique, suite à l'éclosion de 2012, le gouvernement de Québec a pris des mesures pour mieux gérer les tours de refroidissement. Et récemment, il a posé un projet de loi qui inclut bien sûr la détection. Mes résultats auront un impact direct sur comment ces lois seront formées. Mais mon histoire de légionella n'est pas encore finie. Présentement, je suis à la recherche des conditions qui vont redonner à ces bactéries cachées la capacité de repousser sur les géloses pour qu'on puisse enfin les détecter. Ça va améliorer nos méthodes de détection de légionella et va garder nos eaux propres. Avec ça, je vous laisse à la chasse des bactéries cachées. Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Neil Mini. Give people a chance to move around and introduce the next presenter, Lauren Conway, who's from Educational Psychology. Lauren's thesis is Understanding Cyberbullying, the Roles of Moral Emotions and Reasoning. I'll tell you a little bit about Lauren. She comes from Toronto. She did her undergraduate studies, concurrent studies, an honors BA and a B.Ed. from the University of Toronto, majoring in psychology and French. She finished that training in 2012. She's been in Montreal since September 2013. She says she loves the foodie experiences, smoked meat, sushi, pho, and what she calls Montreal-style bagels. She means bagels. her favorite pastimes, anything athletic, going to the gym, running, playing lacrosse, reading. Currently, she's reading Three Cups of Tea by Greg Mortensen and David Oliver Raelynn. What inspired her to pursue her research, she took a year off between her undergrad and graduate studies. During that time, she worked as a research analyst for the Council of Ministers of Education of Canada. Through pan-Canadian assessments, as well as anecdotal stories from representatives across the country, she began to understand the scope of cyberbullying as a pervasive social problem that continues to have detrimental impacts on our provincial and territorial educational systems. She realized that there is a desperate need for informed educational interventions aimed at addressing this issue in a practical and concrete way. And that, she says, is what she is here to do. Lauren Conway.
The word cyberbullying did not exist a decade ago, yet today we know it well. Recent high-profile Canadian cases, such as the suicides of Amanda Todd in British Columbia and Rehtaeh Parsons in Nova Scotia, have emphasized the devastating impacts of this pervasive social problem and made it quite clear that the landscape of bullying has changed drastically. What we once knew about bullying in a traditional sense needs to be reevaluated to account for rapid advancements in technology and the corresponding impact on younger generations, who are now at an alarmingly high risk of cyber threat. My research aims to understand the psychological mechanisms that underlie children's online behavior by focusing on what we call moral emotions and reasoning. I'm not talking about morality in the sense of religious ideals or abstract reasoning about right and wrong. Instead, I'm looking at how our emotions provide immediate feedback for our behavior and shape the way we will act in the future. Since it is unethical to observe real cyberbullying events, we have children and adolescents read hypothetical scenarios and take on the perspective of characters in the stories. We then ask them to explain how they would feel and why. When put in the shoes of the hypothetical bully, participants can either report feelings of guilt and shame for the harm done to the victim, or they can report feelings of pride and elation for the personal gains attained through cyberbullying others. From here, we can assess whether individual variation in how children and adolescents experience these moral emotions can be explained by their age, their gender, and most interestingly, their own experiences with cyberbullying. Another important facet of this research is that it allows us to explore why so many individuals who would not normally participate in face-to-face bullying choose to engage in cyber harassment. By comparing scenarios across different contexts, we can assess whether the physical distance between a cyber bully and a victim buffers children against experiencing the same intensity of guilt and shame as they would in a traditional face-to-face setting. To conclude, this research will benefit parents, teachers, and policymakers by offering a greater understanding of the psychological mechanisms that underlie children's online behavior, as well as inform the development of effective pedagogical approaches and intervention strategies aimed at addressing cyberbullying in schools. Attaining a more profound understanding of children's online behavior will take us one step closer to eradicating this detrimental social problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lauren. I direct an institute called the Institute for the Public Life of Arts and Ideas. One of the things that you're talking about, cyberbullying has a public dimension that schoolyard bullying doesn't have, that contributes, I think, to the kind of force that it has upon the individual. We could talk about that later. The next presenter is Juan Sebastian Rodriguez Alarcón. His topic is addressing the elephant in the room, the consequences of discrimination in the mental health of LGBTQ people. Juan Sebastian Rodriguez Alarcón is a disability rights fellow at the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism at McGill University in the Faculty de Droit. Prior to coming to McGill Law, Juan Sebastian worked as a clinical instructor at the Action Program for Equal and Social Inclusion, a human rights clinic at Universidad de los Andes Faculty of Law, where he spearheaded and supervised human rights advocacy and fact-finding work before UN human rights bodies, the Inter-American Human Rights System, and domestic courts on disability, gender, and LGBTQ issues. Juan Sebastian served as an advisor to the gender equality program at the cabinet of the Minister of the Ministry of Labor in Colombia, and has worked on human rights issues with the Organization of American States at its mission to support the peace process in Colombia and the UN High Commission for Refugees. Juan Sebastian graduated from Universidad de los Andes Faculty of Law in Colombia, and is an LLM candidate by research at McGill. Welcome, Juan Sebastian.
Good afternoon. Disability is a developing concept, a social construction that has changed throughout history. The social model understands disability not only as a product of the physical or mental impairment of an individual, but also as the result of the interaction between the individual and the social barriers that prevent their full inclusion into society. According with the social model of disability, the purpose of my research is to analyze members of sexual minorities that have experienced severe episodes of violence and discrimination merely on the basis of their sexual orientation and gender identity, and to investigate the consequences of their discrimination on their mental health. The reason why I chose this topic was because in one case, I provide legal counseling for a 19-year-old girl in Colombia to recover her legal capacity. In the months preceding the consultation, she came out to her family as a lesbian. Her mother's reaction was to call an ambulance, bring her daughter to a hospital, and request a doctor to diagnose the mental health condition of the client merely on the basis of her sexual orientation. The client was then forcibly admitted in a psychiatric institution, and her mother had her legal capacity removed before a judge. These actions had direct impacts on the mental health of the client. In a study, it was found that suicidal thoughts were disproportionately widespread among lesbian, gays, bisexual, and trans youth, as a direct result of stigma and discrimination. The social environment, which includes bullying, was identified as the most significant impact on the lives of sexual minorities. 47% of trans respondents and 33% of lesbian, gays, and bisexual respondents reported having suicidal thoughts, compared to just 7% of heterosexual youth. Mental health is not just a medical diagnostic, but also an absence of a social well-being that can be affected by the exposure to violence and abuse, lack of decision-making, socioeconomic circumstances, and political and environmental factors. Therefore, with my research, I will demonstrate why the mental health conditions of LGBTQ people should be analyzed from the social model of disability, and hence, why reasonable in order to improve social awareness while also ensuring equal provision and access to essential healthcare. The aim of my research is to promote the transformation of laws and policies in order to achieve a better state of social justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Juan Sebastian. The next presenter is Claire Champagny, who is in psychiatry. Her thesis is un entraînement cérébral pour les enfants souffrant de problèmes d'attention. She's originally French. She was born and raised in New York. Claire has fallen in love with the city of Montreal ever since she arrived 5 years ago. Through her undergraduate studies in psychology, she discovered a passion for pediatric clinical research. When she completes her master's degree, she plans to pursue a PhD in cognitive neurorehabilitation, because to her, there's nothing more inspiring than children who fight to regain their brain. Claire Champagny.
What's the difference between a child with an impulse control disorder and an otherwise healthy child? One of the differences is that the child with the impulse control disorder is going to have lower activation in two key regions of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex that you see right here. These are the brain regions that control emotional regulation, behavioral regulation, impulse control, etc. So what does this mean in a real-world setting? Picture a classroom with, let's say, students that are 10 years old. There's a noise in the back of the classroom. Most students will not turn around because those brain regions are activated and tell them to stay focused on their work. But for a child with an impulse control disorder, those regions will not be activated enough, and it's going to be very hard to fight their instinct, their impulse, to turn around to the noise. So as you can imagine, it's very difficult to succeed in school if you can't focus. What's the solution so far? Medication, right? There are a lot of problems with that. First, it's very controversial because of all the side effects. Second, we're not totally sure we want to be giving kids medications because their brains are in the middle of developing. And then third, there's even debate on whether or not these medications work. So obviously, you would understand the parents are very hesitant to give their children these medications. So we need a safer solution, and that's what I'm doing. We're working on a brain training program. It's a computerized program with cognitive exercises disguised as games. It's just like when you go to the gym. If you want to work your biceps, you're going to take some weights, do a specific movement, and it's working the specific bicep muscle. The games that we developed are specifically working those two regions of the brain. So this game, for example, is called Undercover Spy. And you have to click on the hay once it moves, because there's a wolf hidden if it moves. But you have to wait for the hay to move, and in higher levels, the hay is going to move very, very little, and you might have to wait, 30 seconds before it moves. So this really works your focus, your concentration, and your impulse control. You have to wait before you click on the hay. So far, our results have been very promising. We've worked with different kinds of kids with different kinds of impulse control disorders, such as ADHD, and we have very promising results in terms of behavioral and cognitive progress. And this is why we believe that this brain training program is a realistic therapeutic alternative for kids with impulse control disorders, because it's fun, it's efficient, it's reliable, and it works. So that's my conclusion. We think we should be using brain training for these kids because we genuinely believe that every child should have the opportunity to use the full potential of their brain to succeed in school and to succeed later in life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Claire. Hunting is also, actually, it's really good for teaching focus, and this is kind of like hunting the wolf in the hay. The next presenter is Jonathan Rothstein, who's in otolaryngology. He'll correct me. I'll tell you about Joseph. Joseph was born and raised here in Montreal. His undergrad degree is in physiology. He graduated in 2012. He's currently a master's student in otolaryngology, Department of Head and Neck Surgery. His hobbies include he coaches high school basketball for the past 5 years. He also plays basketball in several different leagues, including McGill Intramurals. And he has also been playing the cello since the age of 7. He answers the question, what inspired his research? He shadowed Dr. Sam Daniel at Montreal Children's Hospital. He wanted to work in a clinical setting with children and their families. And he says he's a people person. He has a genuine passion for helping others. And that genuine passion for helping has fueled his research. He's also done a lot of volunteer work. He plays cello for severely disabled children at the Montreal Association for the Blind. And he says seeing these kids enjoy and react to the music in their own unique way has been an invaluable experience. Being able to look past the disability and see the individual behind the disease has been crucial to his development of his focus on patient-centered care. Joseph.
In my very first week of my master's research, I met a 4-year-old girl who was diagnosed with cancer. She was nearing the end of her treatment, and I found out that her doctors and parents were actually discussing the pros and cons of prematurely stopping that treatment. And I didn't understand. Weren't these drugs saving her life? I mean, why take that risk? What I learned was that while these drugs were saving her life, they were also causing her to become profoundly deaf. What an impossible situation for any parent. How do you decide to cut your child's chemotherapy short so that they don't lose their hearing for the rest of their life? But what if we didn't have to choose? What if there was a way to prevent hearing loss altogether? There are two main chemotherapy drugs used in North America. They're widely used, they're extremely effective, and very successful, but they have a really bad side effect called ototoxicity. Ototoxicity is toxicity of the ear, which results in hearing loss. It's been shown that even a mild hearing loss early on in life can lead to deficits in school performance, social interaction, and cognitive development. And 60% of patients taking these drugs lose their hearing. What's more, it's irreversible. Ototoxicity is permanent. So our only hope is to prevent this side effect before it happens. But the problem with prevention is that we don't know which patients are going to develop ototoxicity. It's extremely variable. So the task becomes, how can we predict who the susceptible patients are? And the answer lies in DNA. It is largely thought that there is something in a patient's DNA that can tell us whether or not they're going to develop ototoxicity. These are called genetic variants, which are essentially mutated genes. Now, my research aims to find out which genetic variants are associated with ototoxicity. How are we going to do this? We've recruited 215 patients. Each patient gives us a blood sample so that we can analyze their DNA to see if they have these variants. And we follow them throughout their treatment with hearing tests to see if they develop ototoxicity. Now, what we found is that there are actually 8 genetic variants which are very likely associated with hearing loss. These 8 can now become biomarkers for susceptibility. What does this mean? Take, for example, a 4-year-old girl who comes into the clinic and is diagnosed with a brain tumor. Doctors will be able to reassure her and her family beforehand, listen, you don't have any of these 8 genetic variants associated with hearing loss, therefore we can go ahead confidently with a full course of chemotherapy. Alternatively, they might say, okay, you have the LRP2 variant. This has been shown to be associated with hearing loss, don't worry. This just means we have to modify your treatment plan ahead of time in order to avoid hearing loss. And there are things we can do. We can lower dosages, we can spread out dosages, we can give a different combination of medication. But it all starts with finding out which genetic variants are associated with hearing loss. With these biomarkers in hand, doctors can identify susceptible patients, modify their treatment plans, prevent ototoxicity, and we can allow these extremely effective chemotherapy drugs to do what they do best, save lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
Last presenter.
Muna Mikhail from Biomedical Engineering. The topic is an injectable biomaterial for spinal cord repair. Muna received his Bachelor in Engineering from Dalhousie in 2006. 2009, completed a Master's in Engineering Science from the University of Western Ontario. He is presently a PhD student here at McGill. After hearing a talk in 2005, Muna became intrigued by the idea of creating living tissues and organs from a patient's own cells, and he immersed himself in the field of tissue engineering for 8 years. Outside of the lab, Muna runs a side tutoring business to nurture his entrepreneurial skills. He reads on various topics, including history, science, and personal development. He enjoys running outdoors whenever, he says, Montreal weather permits. So he must be really out of shape now. And he would not decline a challenge to a game at chess if anyone in the room is game. Muna.
Imagine this. You're driving on the highway one night when all of a sudden you hit black ice and your car swerves out of control and you slam into the median. And in the confusion of it all, you open your eyes and you try to get out of the car to seek help. But what you realize is you can't move or feel your arms or legs. You've just suffered a spinal cord injury to your neck. Now I want you to shrink yourself down to microscopic size and go into the site of injury, and this is what you're going to see. You're going to see long projections running up and down the spinal cord called axons. And they carry information from your brain to the rest of your body and vice versa, which allows us to feel and to move. And there's another interesting population of cells called oligodendrocytes. And these cells literally look like octopuses, sending up to 60 extensions that wrap around those axons. And these wrappings are called myelin. And they're there to preserve the information traveling and allow it to move fast and for long distances. Now, after a spinal cord injury, those oligodendrocytes die, and the myelin is lost, and the axon becomes exposed. And even though the axon is intact, it cannot transmit this information anymore. And this is where my PhD thesis comes in. As a biomedical engineer, I have developed an injectable biomaterial that can be applied during the early stages of spinal cord injury in order to improve the regeneration of oligodendrocytes, to reinstate the myelin, and to allow action potentials or information to travel through these axons once more. What that would mean to the patient is that they will be able to regain some of their movement and some of their sensation. Now, this patented technology has three major advantages over currently existing biomaterials. Number one, it's rapidly gelling. As a matter of fact, within less than 2 seconds of its application in the body, it will form what I call a sponge. And this is very important in a clinical setting because it ensures that it stays wherever the surgeon applies it. The second advantage is that it has very specific chemical and physical properties that target oligodendrocyte regeneration. And we've demonstrated this successfully with both rat and human oligodendrocyte cells. And third, it can absorb up to 10 times its own weight in water, which means we can encapsulate drugs in it to have even a more, an additional therapeutic effect at the site of injury. We hope that this technology can be part of a multifaceted approach to curing spinal cord injuries in the future. But more importantly, we envision a future where individuals who just suffered a spinal cord injury can be wheeled into the emergency room knowing that there's hope. Thank you.
Thank you very much. May I ask the audience to put their hands together for these extraordinary scholars and scientists. We've got a bit of time to put them on the spot and ask them questions and engage them further in their thinking and their research going forward. So let me open up the floor to you. We're going to excuse the judges. Go do your work. The judges will be accepting credit card and cash payments. Sure. Why don't we have all the presenters at the front with me? You guys did fabulously, by the way. Yes, please. Is it on? Doesn't sound like it's on. Now it's on.
One, two, test.
You'll just have to speak.
Check. But my question will be, okay, fine. Thank you very much. My question is addressed to Mrs. Nilmini Mendis, which is in microbiology. Hello. Thank you for your guts to give a speak in French here in Penkiel. I'm sure you can understand English as well.
Yes, I hope so.
Okay. I think your project is pretty interesting because more and more we are facing to unconventional bacteria, especially in hospital. This is a good place to get ill. You go to hospital, you get infection with specific bacteria who doesn't respond to any antibiotics. Do you believe that the future is about discovering novel antibiotics with different mechanism of action to treat these real problem?
That is one method, but I think what our research is kind of focusing on is more prevention, so prevent people from getting sick so that we don't have to use antibiotics. But there's the phenomena that I talked about, it's actually in the scientific literature, it's called viable but non-culturable. So if we, you know, it's kind of relatively new, and as we advance, one of the things that side of research could potentially bring is to allow us to culture bacteria that is not culturable right now. So they're completely inaccessible to us right now, and that might potentially be another way for us to find new, maybe, antibiotics that we've never thought about and have new functions.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that the future is for prevention, not only for bacterial infection, but any other chronic illnesses like cancer. And we can prevent cancer as well. And good luck with your studies.
Thank you.
Just to take a moment to introduce yourself to the members of the audience and to the presenters.
Me?
Yes.
Who I am? Okay, I'm Claude-Alexandre Couture. You can find me on LinkedIn by typing on Google Claude-Alexandre Couture. I'm actually starting an organization related to health science for cancer, but with phytochemicals to avoid any side effects at the beginning. Also, I have another project for nutrition. So I'm working at home right now, and I'm very pleased to be here since in late 80s I was a member of the Grad House here, and in the late 80s then you can figure out the age I have. So I got my PhD, but not from McGill, from University of Montreal. And I guarantee you that at that time, in late 80s, we, with friends, really enjoy to be here at McGill, at the Grad House. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, hi, my name is Maryam Tabrizian from McGill University here. I have a question for the before last presenter talking about the genome of the patient who are susceptible to have a problem after chemotherapies. I'm just wondering if you so far you know about the genes that are involved in this or not yet. Thank you.
Yeah, well, there's actually a lot of research. Thank you for your question. There's actually a lot of research on the genes that are involved, and there are studies with few patients. I mean, there's studies with 25 patients or 30 patients here or there that have identified certain genes. So the study that I'm doing is pretty much to validate what's already been shown in the literature. And we've identified 8 genes. So there's LRP2, there's which is a megalin gene, there's ERCC2. There's a bunch of, they're complicated names, but I mean, these genes have been identified. They're very likely associated. We're just waiting on the final results of our study, and then they could be used in a further study to identify these patients, and there's a prevention study coming out. So there's another study coming out where they're going to use these genes to identify patients and then to actually give them, it's in clinical trial right now, or it's beginning clinical trial, a drug that can prevent ototoxicity. But these genes are identified, and we're just waiting on the final results.
Other questions? I have a question for you.
This is a question for everybody. Okay, I want to tell you, I was at an event like this several years ago, and a person who was doing a postdoc was talking about the history of the translation of Aristotle in the Middle Ages. It just happens it was humanities work. And it was really interesting stuff, and she was really interested in it. And she was really into the details. And finally, somebody put his hand up, and he said, could you tell us why this is important? And she kind of went, oh. And she gathered herself, and she did a wonderful job of explaining to us that it was really important, because so much of the thinking of the West, including the thinking of science, depended on how Aristotle was received, how he was translated. I tell you this story because you guys are absolutely amazing in terms of focus and ability to convey what you're doing and why it matters. So I actually want to ask you, and any of you can respond to this, to tell us how it is that you got to this point where you are able to explain complex work and also explain why it's important in 3 minutes.
When I heard that they were doing a three-minute thesis competition or three-minute thesis presentations, I was very excited to jump on the chance to do that, because in my work, I actually work at the hospital, and in recruiting 215 patients for my study, it's my job to go and meet with the families and the kids and to explain to them the study. And when you're in the oncology ward, usually you don't have 15 minutes to listen to all the jargon and everything like that, and you don't really care at that point. I mean, you're working with your physicians, you want to know how your child's going to be treated. You don't really, when someone comes up to you and is trying to explain the study, you might want to limit their time. So I've met with 80 families. That's why I felt very comfortable explaining it this way. And you have to make it language appropriate for them, and sometimes for the kids who are 10 years old and can understand the nature of the project. And what I've actually found is that when you explain it to them in this easy, very easygoing way, they're very receptive. And it's not, my study isn't something that's going to be invasive and they're going to take up too much of their time. And when they hear it, they're very, very willing to help other people. That's one thing I was astounded by. Everyone's willing to help someone else, because my research isn't going to necessarily help them right away, but they understand that it's going to help kids in the future. And the kids understand that, which is incredible.
Thank you. Anyone else want to speak to this question?
Quand on fait de la recherche en droit, on s'attend pas nécessairement à ce qu'après avoir remis notre mémoire, la loi va changer ou il va y avoir des changements immédiats. Mais il faut comprendre que la recherche, surtout en droit international, ça se fait pas à pas. On bâtit sur ce qui a été fait avant. On extrapole, on avance. Et un des buts, c'est de sensibiliser les gens. Particulièrement avec mon sujet, c'est que les gens comprennent c'est quoi le problème, qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire en tant que consommateur. C'est de comprendre qu'est-ce que ça va changer. Donc, avoir l'opportunité de pouvoir parler, d'être entendu. Quand j'étais au Bangladesh, c'est ça qu'on me disait. S'il te plaît, quand tu reviens, parle-en aux gens, explique-leur aux gens qu'est-ce qu'ils peuvent faire pour nous. On veut ces emplois-là, mais on veut ça mieux. Donc, ça, c'était déjà une opportunité d'être entendu, de pouvoir en parler. Et c'est mon but, d'en parler le plus possible pour que les gens comprennent. Oui?
Oui.
Tu veux que je vais au mic, ou je peux te donner le mic?
Je t'en vais.
Ça va?
Lorsque vous êtes parti à Bangladesh, c'était facile à communiquer avec ces gens, avec les ouvrières, parce que je pense que le gouvernement n'est pas très content que vous soyez là, du Canada, et évoquer les problèmes des droits et tout ça.
Merci. Ça, d'abord, j'avais un interprète avec moi, parce que je parle pas Bangla, mais beaucoup de gens parlent anglais, mais j'avais un interprète avec moi. Il y a eu beaucoup de gens qui sont allés au Bangladesh après le Rana Plaza. Ils en ont vu beaucoup, des journalistes, des ONG. Les gens sont super accueillants. J'ai pas eu aucun problème à parler avec les gens. Les ONG sont habituées de rencontrer des gens. Pour rencontrer les travailleuses, évidemment, j'ai pas été dans les fabriques de vêtements ou les sous-contractantes qui, eux, sont moins, ils respectent pas les normes. Mais évidemment, ceux-là sont pas accessibles. Mais on peut voir ceux qui sont mieux, mais après ça, c'est par des contacts, un coup rendu sur le terrain, rencontrer des chefs d'ONG qui, eux, m'ont dit, est-ce que t'aimerais ça rencontrer les travailleurs chez elles? Je dis, ben oui, j'aimerais ça. Et qu'ils m'ont organisé un soir, on est parti en rickshaw, on est arrivé chez les travailleuses qui nous ont reçus, puis on était tous assis sur un lit, il y avait mon interprète, puis on posait des questions, on discutait, puis on a bu du thé ensemble. Donc, j'ai pas eu de problème rendu là-bas, aucun, tout le monde était super accueillant, super gentil.
Merci.
Pas de...
Yes, Martin.
Well, I was I didn't say this earlier, but the selection process to pick these people involved lots of different people looking at submissions that we received. I'm interesting when I saw the results, and I'm interesting to see it today, that so many of them are master's students and not PhD students. I read that in a certain way, and I also have a plug. I also am interested that the excitement that you've shown for your research is quite edifying. Some of you are going into professional endeavors after your master's, but for those of you who aren't, please do your PhD. Please do it at McGill. And if you're not able to do it, come and see me. I'll make sure that you'll be able to do it at McGill, okay? Because, you know, the kind of enthusiasm you have is you know, there's lots of people who are skilled at research. There are lots of people who are smart. And there are lots of people who can achieve results when they do their research. But the thing that makes it really worthwhile, and the thing I think that makes it really work, are people who have the kind of enthusiasm to engage in these types of things, because the enthusiasm you have for your research and for the particular effects it's going to have, what is the import, what's the impact going to be, is what's going to take you through the very difficult and sometimes challenging years of the PhD. So I think you're well suited to go forward and produce something really great when you're done. So thank you very much.
Here, here. Go ahead.
My question's for Emily. When you were describing the interpretation that they would use that's on phone, I was just wondering, does something like this already exist in different conditions besides primary care, and what would it look like from a user perspective?
It doesn't exist in primary care. It, as I said in my talk, it has become the standard of care in hospitals in Australia, the United States, and West Coast, Canada, and Toronto as well. It has not been used in primary care settings, and why I'm focusing on primary care settings specifically and why it's so important to have this service versus in-person interpreters is because they're geographically spread out. They also have very minimal budgets, they tend to have. So this is a feasible solution rather than in-person interpreters, which are timely, they're costly, and you also have to pay for travel time as well, and it's minimum 2 hours, $60 an hour. So bringing this phone interpretation service into primary care settings, which is fundamental to creating a sustainable healthcare system, for example, by reducing the number of people who are showing up in the emergency department, this is critical. So I'll be piloting in primary care centers, which is the first in Canada, and hopefully it will have applications, widespread applications in Canada and the United States and everywhere. Yeah.
We have another question.
This is just a comment, being a listener today. I would like to thank all your people. You're young, you're intelligent, the society needs you. You have all very important research program to achieve. And like said the guy who looked my age before, go with your PhD. This is very important. We need you guys. And thank you very much. I was very inspired today, and good luck.
First, actually, a comment. If those of you who are not familiar with the Sauvé Foundation, McGill is connected with the Sauvé Foundation, and they have very interesting projects for people who are doing kind of all sorts of ways in which to improve things. There's a man there who's connected to the telephone thing. There was a man there who is a doctor from Nigeria last year, and he's working on a project, and I'll try to give you his name if I can think of it, where they found out in rural areas in Africa, that people don't have access to lots of healthcare. but almost all of them have cell phones. And they found ways in order to get information back and forth, particularly for pregnant mothers who can't leave their houses, in order to get information. So they've started networks of communication. And translation's also an issue, because there's multiple languages that have to get passed back and forth. So even if they get to a hospital, they can't always get the service and language. But sometimes the hospitals are 100 miles away. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's a remarkably important thing. And I think that, you know, there are other people doing different things. And one of the things we need to look for in research is ways to connect these things. And are you ready for the results? Or do you want me? Sorry, go ahead.
No. An important comment to make. So the picture on my slide was actually very primitive. You saw two people holding these handheld things. That's a thing of the past, and that was just to demonstrate that they're using the phone. Otherwise, in a picture, you couldn't tell. It's quite advanced now. You can use iPads. You can use cell phones. You can actually get remote interpreters via video. It's not always just audio. For my pilot project, because of budget constraints, I'm using speaker option on telephones that are already present in the examination rooms, so it's feasible anywhere and everywhere. You don't have to have these burdensome, heavy things. But thank you.
I'm going to invite the presenters.
Thank you. I'm going to invite the presenters to take their seats. I do have the ranking from the judges. I'm glad this was not my task. What I'm going to do is to announce on the English side the honorable mention, and then the three top-ranked presenters from third through first, and then I'm going to announce the winner on the French side. But before I do that, I want to second what a number of us have said to you today, and that is, I feel extraordinarily honored to be here personally, but I also feel that the university is in very good shape. And, you know, one of the things that I've done and Marty has done for our whole careers is try to explain the humanities to people outside the university. I feel if I had you 10 and I could take, you know, I could just spend a month with you and send you out, we would have that job done and done very well. The judges have decided. Honorable mention goes to Jay Olson.
You can stay up. Enjoy it.
The third ranked finalist is Joseph Rothstein. The second ranked finalist is Claire Champigny. Thank you. And the winner on the English side is Alexandra Blair. You get a prize. And I'm very pleased to tell you that the winner of the competition on the French side is Neil Meany Mendes. Congratulations.
Great work.
Thank you for all of you for being here today. Thank you to Marty for making it possible, to Jennifer for actually making it possible, for the judges for their extraordinary hard work, and first and foremost to you, the 10 of you, the competitors and collaborators in the work of education and research and scholarship. Thank you so much.